Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, a weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by lovely news editor Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And lovely online editor Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
And Jack's just been for a super secret screening, haven't you, Jack? But you can't say anything about it.
Yeah, I can't say anything about that.
So that's exciting. But we are here to discuss, in case you are unaware, Shang-Chi or Shang-Chi. Shang-Chi? How do we think it?
Shang-Chi.
We'll get Shang-Chi. It right one day. I don't feel too bad not getting it right because there is a whole scene in this film where people discuss how to pronounce it. So it's not just me struggling with it. But we are doing a spoiler cast today. So if you haven't seen this film, please go no further. Here is your final warning. Here's your alert. And if you have, let's progress and see what mountains open for us as we delve into this film. This is what we're talking about today. It's Shang-Chi.
I thought I could change my name. Start a new life. But I could never escape his shadow.
Okay, so Jordan, perhaps you can set us up with this, where this story comes in the whole Marvel universe and who it introduces us to.
Yes, so we're post-Endgame. This is a post-Endgame world where half the universe disappeared and then came back. This introduces us to Shang-Chi, who's the latest big Marvel hero. Expect to see him in a lot of Marvel films going forward. He is the master of Kung Fu. He's an incredible fighter. And really, it's about him coming into power and his connection to the 10 rings of the title.
The 10 rings, yes, which are bangles, not rings that you wear on your fingers or in any other part of your body.
As they were in the comics, I believe, rings that were worn on the fingers. I don't know about rings that were worn elsewhere. That's probably a bit too risque for comics.
Could be intimate, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about this then. You know, you just said that you expect to see him in the further Marvel adventures. I mean, I think we get a pretty strong indication of that. We do get two post-credit sequences, and the first one does indicate that there will be more because we see Captain Marvel and also Hulk, Bruce Banner, discussing the 10 rings and what they do, but also the fact that they'll probably see them around. They're swapping phone numbers or not in the case of Captain Marvel. Did you enjoy that bit? Did that
pager
give
numbers.
You pager numbers? Of course. I mean, she only has the pager. And also, like, does she even use a phone apart from to do sort of intergalactic messages from payphones in the 90s? Does she actually use them? I don't think so.
Where would she carry a mobile in that suit? Like, it's pretty skin tight. There's not pockets that I'm aware of.
But, you know, like if you've got some running trousers, you've got like a little phone holder on your leg. Surely they'd think of that, wouldn't they, if they were making a suit? She'd need other stuff. I mean, would she not need like a, you know, like her debit card?
Who made her suit? Yeah.
Well, true.
She changed the colour of it. Maybe she can add pockets whenever she wants.
Yeah, or wear a little crossbody bag. Who knows? So, yeah, did it excite you that this film that we've seen is very fully immediately integrated into the future things we'll be seeing?
I have to say, what? I love that we're diving straight into the post-credit scenes.
But that's the thing you want to know, isn't it?
They're the most exciting bits. Yeah, they're so good. Sorry, you go, Jack. I interrupted.
I mean, I am excited. I quite liked Shang. I thought he was a fun character, and he's obviously got another big, powerful Avenger to add to the team. You know, this isn't a Hawkeye. This is a bloke who's got very powerful rings. But even without them, you know, his kung fu skills are definitely
Jordan,
up there.
Jordan, stop sniggering about rings.
It wasn't me with the innuendo.
I didn't say anything. I mean, the interesting thing about the post-credit scene to me, as well as it obviously setting up further adventures, but we can't really deduce too much about that because the rings, they send up a message into space, like this beacon that there is something out there. But there's not really much precedence, even in the comics, for what the rings would be communicating with. It's kind of like this unknown. So it could link to the Captain Marvel sequel, or it could be something completely different. There's not much to know. I mean, again, though, what's interesting to me is Captain Marvel's hair, because obviously she's
terrible
got
wig.
Long hair here, which says well, it's not, that's not Endgame Captain Marvel, but then Hulk's there and Hulk's no longer in Professor Hulk mode.
Nope.
But his arm is also in a sling, which you think, oh, so that must have happened after Endgame, because obviously he snapped half the universe back into reality and got damaged through that. So we're saying that her hair grew that long in the time it took for his arm to still be in a cast.
It's the Infinity Gauntlet. Like, come on, that's going to be a serious injury, isn't it?
I thought that was like permanent damage, to be honest. Yeah. I thought
maybe he'll always have a sling from now on.
My big question was, why isn't he Professor Hulk
anymore?
Well,
he is expected to appear in She-Hulk, so...
Yes, why isn't he Professor Hulk anymore? Has it not worked out for him? He wasn't even wearing a cardi.
I thought that was meant to be like a permanent melding as well, but maybe I've just completely got the wrong end of the stick there. But no, I thought this was a very exciting scene. I enjoyed it a lot. Though I will say my enjoyment of this scene was completely ruined by the fact that at the screening I attended, which was the big UK multimedia screening at the Odeon in Leicester Square, exactly at the moment that the post-credits scene started happening, someone's phone in front of me, directly in front of me, started like flashing, like disco flashing, like its flashlight was going on and off. And then a security guard like immediately swooped down on this phone and stood in front of me for at least half of this scene. So I was kind of craning my neck around,
to go
like, trying to tell what the hell was going on. It was unbelievable. Like, the timing couldn't have been worse. I was irate. But what I did see, I found incredibly exciting. It was just cool to see two huge characters in this film as well, because up until this point, there weren't a great deal of connections to the wider universe. You know, you got mentions of the snap and people.
It was usually Nick Fury that turns up, isn't it? To give a little nod to somebody. You actually get Avengers in this one.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool. It's really cool. So it felt like they were going all in and saying, yes, this is the Ten Rings and Shang-Chi are going to be a huge part of this universe going forward. Get ready.
Yeah, I think what seems nice about it, though, is that, you know, without those connections through the movie, it definitely felt like Shang-Chi's movie. And it was like his properly. And then it wasn't like we need to, like, you know, force him to be an Avenger straight away. Although, you know, obviously he had some of the cameos throughout it that tied it to the wider universe, with kind of with Wong popping up. I quite like the idea of Wong being like the next Nick Fury, introducing, getting all the Avengers back together and stuff. And it kind of being this interesting new group.
And him just turning up through his sort of fire wheel in opportune moments, like, hi, I know you're having drinks, but can we go, please? Be quite useful if you could do that when you didn't want to be somewhere, wouldn't it?
He's also more fun than Nick Fury, because you know, he's good in a karaoke booth.
Yeah.
And he just wants to get pissed with you. It's great. I would definitely have Benedict Wong kind of.
We
just
don't
appear.
Know that Nick Fury doesn't enjoy karaoke, do we?
I mean, yeah, it's not canon, but I would be surprised if he does.
I mean, I think what songs would they like? I think Wong would probably sing Ring of Fire, wouldn't he? What would Nick Fury, another Johnny Cash probably, you know, like when the
Eye
man
of the Tiger
comes around. Yeah, could be. Maybe he likes that. Or The Power of Love. Who knows? I'd love to know what Nick Fury sings in karaoke. Maybe we'll ask Samuel L. Jackson next time we interview him. So let's get back then to Shang-Chi and his story. Shall we go back to the beginning, seeing as we started at the end? I mean, this starts with this beautiful encounter between his parents that I just thought set the tone so beautifully for this ethereal and magical world we were about to be thrown into. It sort of took you away from sort of the grittiness that you might think it was if, you know, this guy who's living in San Francisco as a car valet, and told you that actually this is going to be magical. There are going to be dragons. There are going to be massive lions, which I loved, which we'll get onto. Did you enjoy that scene with the sort of the battle in the enchanted forest between his parents?
Yeah, I mean, I love Tony Leung in this. I thought he was fantastic. I think one of the interesting things is what the marketing kept secret. And I feel like I didn't get this mystical vibe from what we saw in the trailers and stuff. It felt like it was kind of going to be another by the numbers Marvel movie that was maybe a bit more kind of self-serious. Like, this intro, I was immediately kind of taken back and, you know, transported somewhere else. This was one of the films I've saw in like the big screen, and obviously we've been doing more screenings, but this one definitely felt like such a big screen adventure, and I was so glad to be seeing it with all these people around me and on with it in front of me. So this opening was great. I really, really enjoyed it. What do you think, Jordan?
Yeah, terrific. One of my favorite sequences in the entire film, I think. Really inspired by, you know, all the wuxia action films of Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Zhang Yimou's House of the Flying Daggers, all that kind of stuff. If you've seen those films, you kind of know what to expect here. But it's incredibly well done, you know, beautifully choreographed. I love the fact that in these sequences, even like the wind and the leaves blowing around are just part of the character of the sequence. It's all part of the choreography, this beautiful action dance. I thought it was all done incredibly well.
And incredibly romantic as well. Like the way they were sort of looking at each other and just was, as you say, transporting.
Yeah, it was really exceptionally well done. And what I was most surprised by is that it's, you know, it's just one of several different styles of combat that are in this film, really. You get these wonderful homages to Eastern action cinema, and then you've got, you know, the quite fierce and ferocious just hand-to-hand combat, which is demonstrated most ably in the Muni bus fight sequence, which goes on for an exceptionally long time. It's just so well done. For me, it was the real action high point of the entire film, despite the fact it's one of the first big action sequences. Definitely the best fight sequence in the MCU, I would say. Just really, really well choreographed, just incredibly exciting and tense. Just the way they shot it just felt like a step above anything else I'd seen in the MCU. Just felt like they'd really upped their game. You know, there's very little editing. It's all kind of wide angle lenses, so you really get to take in the fact that it really is like Simu Liu who's doing a lot of these action sequences himself. He's a very capable action star. There are some really fun homages to Jackie Chan films in there.
Yeah,
that really like set it up on a high point for me. I was like, yes, we're in for something great with this. If they've nailed it this early, then I felt then it was going to be something special.
That speed kind of nod in as well with Awkwafina sort of as Katie driving the bus, but she's not like a Sandra Bullock. She's a kick-ass, you know, woman in her own right, and she's sort of this strong figure. Yeah, I mean, that fight is amazing, but also I thought the fight on the scaffolding in Macau was amazing as well. And that sort of had echoes of sort of Skyfall, the fight that Bond has with the assassin at the top of a skyscraper, where sort of lights flash and there's reflections and things like that. Did you like that one as much, or is the bus still the one to beat?
I mean, the bus was the pinnacle for me, but I did enjoy the element of danger in the scaffolding fight, because Katie's there as well. And obviously she isn't as capable as everyone else. And you are like slightly nervous that she's going to take a tumble. But again, I thought that was beautifully done. There's a bit more kind of wire work in that scene. So that's kind of a nice melding of the, you know, the wuxia style fighting and the more grounded hand-to-hand stuff that they're doing in the bus scenes. It all felt like there was a nice gradual gradient going on there. It felt like every sequence was tackling the action from a slightly different angle, which never felt like you were just repeating the same thing again and again.
I think the fight along up the side of the skyscraper was maybe my least favorite of the action sequences in the movie, actually. I thought it...
Sour puss.
Yeah.
I know. Well, there has to be a least favorite out of all of them. I mean, I did like the bus one a lot. And I thought some of the kind of like wide angle side shots were reminiscent of like Old Boy and stuff, which was really cool. And then, you know, when we kind of went up this scaffolding and it felt slightly more like MCU-y. Wasn't the biggest fan of like Katie Awkwafina's character like hanging onto this pole and nearly falling off and stuff. It was just a bit, it didn't quite work for me. And I think I also wanted to see more of the cage fighting that had just gone on. You know, we'd seen Abomination versus Wong, but I wanted to see a few more rounds of like heroes kicking each other's ass and stuff. I think that would have been quite fun.
you just want Shang-Chi Fight Club, basically.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's probably a director's cut of that. But did you not like the fact that also, you know, we've obviously seen his sister in the ring here, sort of showing her prowess, but then narratively this fight on the scaffolding works in order to show that she's not the Ice Queen that she's just portrayed. She does actually, you know, come from a good place and has feelings and is going to be there to literally catch Katie when she falls. It sort of served that purpose if it didn't actually hit all the buttons for you in an action way.
Yeah, I think on a narrative level, obviously, it, you know, makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the interesting things about this movie is that it's almost not just the Shang-Chi film. It kind of takes in all these other characters and spends quite a lot of time with, you know, the sister. It's it could have easily have been both of them kind of going through everything together. And if they'd spent even more time with her, it would have been a two-hander of a movie. And it acts as an origin story for the both of them. I mean, I feel like that's the first time one of these solo superhero movies has really paid that much attention to other characters as well, in a way. I would say at times it kind of came to the detriment of Shang-Chi himself. I would have maybe have liked to see more of him as well, but that's why we get loads of sequels. You know, Doctor Strange didn't introduce any other hit. Well, I mean, it introduced Wong, I guess, but he's, you know, now he's had Endgame and a few other movies to kind of really come into his own. But you know, Shang-Chi's sister feels like a proper character already.
Reminded me of Ant-Man in a bit, in the sense that that feels like an origin story for the Wasp as well as Ant-Man. And then obviously the sequel, you got them both having top billing in the title. So that could happen with the second Shang-Chi film.
Or might be triple billing with Katie, because obviously she has some mad skills at the end of this. She's very good with a bow and arrow. She gets sort of taught a lot of things that he also needs to learn. You know, this sort of, if you aim at nothing, you hit nothing. And that, you know, you really need to determine what it is you want out of life, and whether that's you're a kick-ass superhero or me. It's sort of really nice to follow Awkwafina and her journey on this as a normal person, as no superpowers, no rings, no nothing, and how she could become a super person, not super powered, but a super person, by sort of following her heart and doing the right thing. I really like that aspect of it. And I just think she's cracking, isn't she? She just delivers all her lines with such deadpan brilliance that she's just really funny. I mean, this film made me laugh out loud a lot more, I think, than many other, you know, Marvel films. I think the one I had the most sort of fun laughing at was probably Thor Ragnarok. But this has that same sort of anarchic fun about it that I really enjoyed as well.
Yeah, just before my screening, they brought out Simu and Awkwafina and the entire cast, but those two in particular were just kind of riling each other up left, right, and center. And I think actually it was Simu who made like this crack. There was a guy cosplaying at the front as Iron Fist, and he just turns around and says in spark phrase, just like, "Read the room, man." And it was just like, it was like such a good put down. But that would definitely kind of like prepared me for their 1-2 banter in the movie as well. Yeah. Did you find it romantic?
No, I was going to say
she was in love with him a bit, but that they just wouldn't.
The thing that I enjoyed about it was the fact that it wasn't romantic, that it was just a platonic friendship, because you have that, you know, early Asian soap opera scene where they go to Katie's family's house and they have breakfast around the table and the grandmother says, "When are you going to marry her?" or whatever. And then there's just not really any hint of it beyond that. They're just pals who hang out and go through this incredible experience together. I found that quite refreshing, actually.
But I think there was room for it to get romantic if it wanted to in later installments. It could do.
Yeah, I mean, she checks them out, doesn't she?
I thought she would, like, when she was in the cage fight and he came out topless, she was like, "What?" And I thought that was a little bit like, "What? I've not really noticed that my friend is hot."
If your best friend had like a body like that, you would like look twice, right? And it doesn't mean that you fancy them.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, he's been covering it up. It's not like he was covering up his body with a horrible look anyway, because this guy has a great line in bomber jackets and sneakers. He's looking good already. So yeah. I just felt like that was a little like, oh, hello. Perhaps that was just me and my own interpretation of the situation, because that, yeah, you could bounce a lemon off those abs. I don't know why you'd be bouncing a lemon, but there we go.
A lemon, yeah.
I don't know why. What would you bounce off abs? A coin? I don't know. That's what they do, don't they? Yeah, a coin.
It's what I bounce off my abs anyway. Well, I don't know about you guys.
Yeah.
I'll just add that I enjoyed Katie. For me, she was a bit more of a comic relief figure more than anything. I was much more excited by Shang-Chi and Xiling, his sister. I just found their dynamic really fascinating, because you have this fact that, you know, he's left her behind in the Ten Rings compound when she's a teenager. She's kind of quite resentful and bitter about that still. So there is like a real journey that she goes on. And the fact that Menga Zhang, the actress, this is her first film, which is unbelievable to me. Like, absolutely unbelievable.
She's got such presence.
Yeah, she was absolutely terrific, and really holds her own in the action sequence as well. Almost as accomplished as Shang-Chi in some senses. So there's really a lot of potential for her as a character going forward as well.
The human relationship, especially like the brother-sister stuff, I always wanted them to go further with that, especially within the last third. You know, we kind of did the classic Marvel thing of we're going to get lots of CGI. It wasn't like the same as it's always been. You know, there were dragons, which was very exciting and stuff like that.
And those massive lions and that Morris, the pig chicken thing.
Well, I enjoyed the creatures a lot. I think the action itself, though, it was a bit too much for me. I could have done with things being narrowed down towards the end to really hone in on the familial elements, you know, the brother, sister, and especially the father stuff. There wasn't necessarily a need for the world ender or whatever it was called.
The dweller in darkness.
Yes.
Dweller in the darkness.
Which is what we call you, Jack.
thanks, guys. I'm not sure, like, how did you guys find the third act, especially like when we got to that kind of big battle? Because I really liked the world we got to. I liked Michelle Yeoh. I thought she was great. And when we brought, you know, we had the lions and tigers and all these creatures and stuff, and basically, you know, Middle Earth going on and stuff like that. I loved that stuff, but I thought the actual battle was confusing. I thought it was just a bit, just didn't work for me on that level.
Would you not want to ride a giant dragon and like swirl water up into spirals and things? I mean, I thought it was just wish fulfillment that I really enjoyed. What do you think, Jordan?
It didn't work for me, sadly. I thought the moment that we got to Ta Lo, it kind of fell apart for me, to be honest. I just wasn't particularly enchanted by it. I just kept thinking of the time that when I watched Black Panther for the first time, and that first time where you enter Wakanda and you've just got like goosebumps, and you're just thinking, wow, what an amazing world. And with this, it just felt like they were going into like a garden center or something. Like, it just looked so small to me. Like,
I don't know if they filmed on a center.
Yeah, it just looked so small.
What garden center are you going to?
I mean, there's some nice garden centers near me. I live in Essex. So, I mean, it looked to me like it was filmed on the soundstage. I don't know if it was, but it felt small. It didn't feel epic in the way that I wanted it to. I definitely enjoyed some of the creatures, especially Morris, who's an absolute legend. Just so cute. But I just didn't find it magic in the way that I think I was supposed to find it magic. And I thought like the entrance to Ta Lo was just much more like magical than actually Ta Lo itself. It just didn't entirely work for me. And then I would echo Jack's sentiments in the whole dragon great protector versus dweller in the darkness kind of showdown at the end. Just felt like they put all their currency in the wrong type of action towards the end. Like, I enjoy a good, you know, visual effects driven set piece as much as anyone towards the end of the film, but that clearly wasn't this film's strength. You know, you'd had three or four like absolutely terrific hand-to-hand combat sequences, and then in the last 20 minutes all we get is some brief flurries between Shang-Chi and Wenwu, you know, which are also very heavily VFX enhanced, because Wenwu is using the 10 rings throughout this entire fight. It just felt like everything that it built on, they just threw away for something that it felt like it had to do. Like, every Marvel film has to end in a big VFX extravaganza, even something like WandaVision, where it's like television sitcom for 90% of it, and then the last 10 minutes have to be a big VFX showdown between two witches. It just felt like, oh, we're doing this again, are we?
Yeah.
Like, you did get the emotional heft of, you know, the father-son, you know, Luke Vader-type fight in the middle of all of that, which I think, to credit the actor's abilities there in the middle of all that green screen, you know, I had shed a little tear for horrible old dad popping his clogs. The look in his eyes, I mean, he's just a great actor as his soul was sucked out of him. It was amazing. And I sort of felt that allowed everything else and was not going to be bothered about it, because I think that was the sort of emotional money shot for me.
It wasn't for me. That shot did not work for me.
I thought Jack laughed out loud in the cinema. Yeah, he was like, good, he's dead.
I didn't want him to die. I thought he was a really interesting character, and I thought the performance was fantastic. I mean, I think he's a brilliant actor, you know, In the Mood for Love and all that is, you know, one of my favorites. So So I was thrilled to see him on the big screen so much, especially because he's one of the few villains we've actually had, you know, we've actually spent quite a bit of time with in this movie. You know, we've had Marvel movies before, like even my favorite Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, who's the villain in that? Ronan the Conqueror in it for all of 5 minutes. So, you know, I was glad to see a change there. I think it was too much. Like, everything going on in that finale was, I felt like I was being kind of like, after seeing all these, you know, really interesting martial arts sequences that were just shot so well and so fluid, well edited, well put together, and then suddenly to have so many pieces going on, it took away anything for me, I think. And talking about like other Marvel stuff, you know, I found the same in Black Widow as well. You know, a movie I liked for the most part, but then suddenly we went to a flying fortress in the sky. That was completely against what this non-super character was about. You know, I think I am slightly bored of these big CGI Marvel sequences that are almost like a requirement rather than a natural path for the story and the characters to go down. Maybe that's a bit harsh. I know some people really, really love them, but you know, we've seen superhero movies that don't do that. You know, you think about, I mean, obviously it's R-rated, but Joker and the final sequences of that, and that's a completely character-driven, very different movie. But I still remember like the thrill of watching that in the cinema and the feeling within the audience. And it's like, maybe we could just keep it on a character level and to still have that feeling rather than needing to go like big and bombastic.
It will be interesting to see if Chloe Zhao can do that with the Eternals and see if she can bring that character driven thing that she does in her films to this. And if she can temper that a little bit, we will see.
I mean, you don't even have to look to the future. I mean, look at Loki, like it has a big VFX element in the penultimate episode, but that series ends with three people talking in a room for half an hour. Like, they've proven that they can do it if they want to. It's just, sometimes I think they just feel the need to end on these ridiculous VFX driven highs that don't always feel warranted. I would agree with you, Jack, that I really enjoyed Tony Leung in this film. Just what an absolute treat to see him in like in a movie like this, like long overdue. I can't believe it's taken this long for someone to be able to tempt him over to America. You know, probably my favorite extended sequence in the entire film is that middle section where you go to like the Ten Rings compound, and it's really just Wenwu and Shang-Chi and Katie and Xiling just hanging out and chatting over like a dinner table and stuff. Like, I thought that was great just because you get to spend so much time with those characters and the motivations just feel so like thorny and knotty, and there's so many conflicting emotions. Like, you kind of want them to get on with their dad, but their dad's killed, like he's committed genocide and killed like thousands of people throughout his lifetime. Like, you genocide. Know he's a terrible guy, so it's like, can you trust him? No, of course you can't trust him, but you still want them to kind of reconcile and for this to work out for them. You want to believe that they're going to be reunited with their mother, but it all gets kind of torn away from you. I thought all that stuff was really great. It was almost soap opera-y to a point where it was just all about the family, and it almost forgot it was Marvel film for like a good chunk of time. And that stuff I thought was really like brave and really interesting and exciting, but then it all just like crumbled as soon as they get to Talo for me. But
well hang on, there's somebody else at that compound which we haven't mentioned who we should talk about.
Certainly is.
Ben Kingsley returning as the Mandarin. Not the real one, the fake one. This very strange accent that he's doing, a Liverpudlian apparently.
Trevor Slattery, the toast of Croydon, you mean? Absolute hero.
Absolute hero.
I love him. I love him. I mean, he was obviously a very controversial character when Iron Man 3 came out because of what he was supposed to represent and people feeling slightly cheated by that twist. But I thought that twist was absolutely genius. Genuinely one of the best rug pulls Marvel have ever done. And I had no idea he was going to be in this. I was so surprised and delighted when he turned up. Yeah, I was overjoyed. He's just so funny in this. Just hilarious. And I loved his relationship with Morris as well. Just so heartwarming. Genuinely the most touching.
You can see him too. And for ages, he thinks this is just something in his imagination that he's actually going bananas. I also loved his whole chat about when he wanted to act, and it was when he saw Planet of the Apes and he realizes that, you know, if monkeys can act, then he could act. If monkeys can ride horses, and they're just like all looking at him like, No, I just thought that was really funny writing, and the way that they all delivered that was absolutely hilarious. But from a sort of more sort of Marvel lore point of view, does this right the wrongs then to sort of bring him back and sort of explain that, you know, oh, actually that thing that happened wasn't, you know, really quite good. And there's this actual Mandarin that's even more powerful and terrifying than he was ever portraying. Did it sort of work for you on that level of the sort of reconstructing of previous Marvel films?
Yeah, I think definitely for me. I mean, especially when you consider the one shot they did with Iron Man 3, they released like a mini film that had Ben Kingsley in prison as Trevor, as the fake Mandarin. And then suddenly the real Ten Rings show up, and it was always like a, you know, it's been a really long tease for essentially this movie. Whether they knew at the time what it was going to look like, who knows, but they have managed to incorporate this, you know, small 5-10 minute thing in and make it like a really important part of the MCU. And I think that's really interesting. I quite like how they're using the groundwork to kind of bring in characters, and even, you know, talking about the post credits when they brought in Captain Marvel and Hulk and stuff, and just being able to pull from, you know, this huge groundwork that has been built over 24 movies, but also do it in a way that I don't feel like you necessarily need to have watched everything beforehand to get on with the movie. It does it in a way that is like, it still works even if you haven't seen Iron Man 3. And I know that because my brother hasn't seen Iron Man 3 and he watched this with me. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, I quite like Ben Kingsley. And I was like, yeah, he was in Iron Man 3. Remember that? And he was like, no idea. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, it worked for me.
Personally, I would quite like to see what happened to Trevor and his lovely little friend, Morris. I mean, obviously, they've survived the battle because they're playing dead in the field. Where are
That's
they?
Acting,
are they
right there?
Are they just hanging out, having a great time in Tarlow? Is he putting on Shakespeare for them? Are they enjoying his Hamlet? What's he doing? Is he going to turn up elsewhere?
They're doing a spin-off of Black Panther, aren't they? Just called Wakanda.
Yeah,
it's going to be about the place there. I mean, they could just do the same here with this and then just kind of every time they introduce a new place somewhere in the MCU, they just kind of like have a spin-off show about it. But it would be pretty cool. I'd see more of those like tigers and stuff. And I'm sure there's going to be another.
They're not tigers. They're lions.
More
those
lions.
Big giant lions. And then you've got like a four-tailed Arctic fox thing.
Yeah,
and those sort
gorgeous.
Of like butterfly horse things.
There's going to be another door of like covering up some more darkness somewhere, isn't there? Which they're
some
going to
more
have to
death
like.
Eaters.
Yeah, they were not very nice, were they? Sort of squiddy.
Soul suckers. Yeah,
I don't like. I don't enjoy soul sucking as a rule. I don't enjoy a Dementor for that reason. It's not a nice thing, is it? Anyway, we should totally talk about the second post-credit sequence as well. Speaking of where people end up, Jia Ling is now the queen of. The Ten Rings compound, and she's teaching women. She's not just letting the boys have a go at it. But what else is going on in that sequence that is quite enticing?
Well, she's teamed up with Razor Fist, obviously, who was kind of an enjoyable enough character throughout the rest of the film. I was mainly taken with the kind of James Bond style-y, the Ten Rings will return kind of caption that we ended on. Like that made me wonder, well, it made me think, is Shang-Chi 2 basically going to be a brother-sister battle? Is that how this is going to work now? Like, it's quite intriguing that they're already setting up like more conflict for that family, which I think could work quite well.
I wasn't sure about if it was going to be conflict or whether like she's going to turn the Ten Rings into like a force for good.
Yeah, I thought she was turning it into a force for good. Were you just thinking she's going to be just bad to the bone?
It looked well evil to me. Are you kidding? Like... She gave it like this graffiti makeover, and come on, she was clearly up to bad stuff there, I reckon. And she's been running like her little fight club in Macau, which is definitely a bit dodgy this whole time. Like, I think she's turned into the dark side personally, but maybe I'm not a trusting person. I'm misreading that.
An enterprising woman who thought, this is a business I can get into. You know, she could do merchandising for it, buy the Ten Rings t-shirt, get a, you know, an online class. Who knows? She might just be, you know, perfectly above board.
All she says is, let's get started and we've got a lot of work to do, which they're ambiguous phrases. It could mean anything, I guess. I should really give her the benefit of the doubt.
We wait and see. it's obviously been really well received. It's done amazing box office, hasn't it?
It's like a record-breaking Labor Day box office in the US where it made like 94 million over 4 days. So it's like one of the best showing since the before times.
So does this mean that like the Ten Rings and Shang-Chi have actually like saved cinema?
I mean, you're not far off. I would say, you know, we've already seen Venom 2 move forward its release date. You know, Carnage is coming on October 1st instead of October 15th. You know, obviously buoyed by the fact that this movie's done well and superhero movies can do well. I mean, the biggest upset really has been Top Gun moving. And now it does, I would say, feel maybe potentially slightly premature, kind of vacating its slot so much. But then again, I think the real test will still be No Time to Die when that comes out. You know, the big James Bond movie, especially over here in the UK. You know, it's the kind of thing that everyone and their dads is going to see. But I think this is definitely a positive sign. And I'm glad it's not on Disney Plus, because I think that could have really damaged it. There's a lot to talk about with streaming releases, but I think one thing that people haven't quite clocked is just how much they're getting pirated. You know, the moment like an HD copy of a movie's on the streaming service, it's immediately on, you know, a pirate website somewhere. At least when it's in the cinema, it's only one of those crappy hand cams and no one's going to watch one of those all the way through. Now it's like a proper 4K copy. I think it's been really damaging. And hopefully next year, we're not going to have the same amount of Disney Plus or HBO Max in the US releases, because I think otherwise, you know, cinema will suffer as a result. There's a rant for you.
Yeah, there we go. Well, Jack just went into his own thing and also demonstrated that he has seen such things.
I would just maybe add, you know, you can't sell short the importance of how big the opening weekend for this film was. It's actually the biggest pandemic opening in the UK since 1917. So like absolutely huge. I would say
that's the movie, also, not the year, we should stress.
Exactly. Definitely. The Sam Mendes movie, not for 100 years. We should stress the fact that, you know, this is Marvel's first film with an Asian American lead and how important it is that this film in particular has done so well and what it means for the future of representation in the MCU. But I will say that I think the second week is possibly the more important week than the first week, just because, you know, when Black Widow came out, that had a huge opening weekend, a bigger opening weekend than Shang-Chi did, but it absolutely tanked in the second week, basically, which a lot of people have put down to the fact it was on Disney Plus and available to buy on Disney Plus for a premium price. And if Shang-Chi manages to have less of a drop-off, then that's a pretty compelling argument that the Disney Plus model may not entirely work for Marvel films. But, you know, it's a very complicated question. You know, not everyone's ready to return to the cinema. Not everyone feels safe doing it. And those people are missing out on a huge Marvel film because they can't watch it at home. So I feel a lot of sympathy for people like that. But there's big arguments for and against. And I'm just glad that it's done well in its first week and we can look forward to more Shang-Chi in the future more than anything.
Indeed. So on that note, I think we'll probably close out. And I would like to go back to Talo, just relax, polish my dragon scale sword. And wait until I can go and see this film again on the big screen.
I want to hang out with Morris. Like, I think he'd make a good footstool for when I'm watching it the second time.
I want to see how he eats. Presumably he has a method to eat, but he has no mouth. How does it work?
How is he talking with Trevor? They were like...
telepathy.
Yeah.
I think there's more to dig in here, definitely. So I want to know more about that. I actually can't wait until this comes out on like a loaded Blu-ray with all the extras, because I hope there's a lot more stuff about Trevor and Morris and what they've got up to.
We need the Trevor and Morris Disney Plus series immediately. Stat. Indeed. Get on it, Marvel.
Yeah, commission that. Okay, so on that note, let's say goodbye and we will return next week with more reviews of new releases. So say goodbye, boys.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.